The Vox transmission cut out at precisely 14:30 shipboard time, leaving nothing but static hissing through the bridge speakers of the Prophet's Edge. I watched Engine Seer Kine's augmetic fingers dance across the communication array's brass controls, his mechadendrite tentacles weaving between exposed cables as he attempted to re-establish contact with the bloodied claw. The raider vessel had been transmitting regular updates throughout their pillaging operation against a merchant convoy in the outer reaches of the Coronis Expanse, their captain's gruff voice crackling through the void with reports of seized cargo and captured crew. Now there was nothing. Kine's organic eye twitched as he cycled through different frequencies, the crimson glow of his optical mechadendrite casting eerie shadows across his pallid features. His binary cant whispered through the bridge's recycled air as he communed with the ship's machine spirit, but even the sacred rituals yielded no response from the pirate vessel. The bloodied claw had simply vanished from the Vox channels as if it had never existed. Captain Mordian paced behind the command throne, his weathered face creased with concern. The bloodied claw represented a significant investment in our current operation, and their sudden silence threatened to disrupt carefully laid plans. The raider's crew consisted of 43 souls, all bound by contract to our rogue trader charter, and their vessel carried enough firepower to reduce a system defense monitor to scrap metal. I felt the familiar weight of responsibility settle on my shoulders as Mordian's gaze found mine across the bridge. As bosun of the Prophet's Edge, salvage operations fell under my purview, and the captain's unspoken command was clear enough. The bloodied claw needed investigation, and I would lead the boarding party to determine what had befallen our wayward allies. The journey to the raiders' last known coordinates took 6 hours through the treacherous asteroid fields that littered this particular sector of the expanse. Our auger arrays painted a picture of drifting debris and scattered wreckage from the merchant convoy, but the bloodied claw itself remained intact, hanging motionless against the star field like a predator that had simply stopped mid-hunt. Through the observation deck's armored viewports, I studied the vessel's familiar silhouette. The bloodied claw was a converted escort frigate, her hull bristling with additional weapon mounts and boarding torpedoes that gave her the appearance of a mechanical sea urchin. Her running lights were dark, and no exhaust plumes emerged from her plasma drives. She drifted with the slow, inexorable motion of a derelict, her prow pointed toward the system's dying star. I assembled my boarding party in the Prophet's Edge's main launch bay, selecting men whose loyalty and competence I could trust without question. Corporal Hadris brought his combat experience from the Cadian 47th, his scarred face bearing witness to countless boarding actions and close quarters engagements. Tech Adept Vorn would handle any technical difficulties we might encounter, his servo skull familiars already conducting preliminary scans of the target vessel. Trooper Kellen and Trooper Mace rounded out our complement, both veterans of void warfare whose steady nerves had been tested in the cramped confines of ship-to-ship combat. The boarding torpedo Reaper's Kiss carried us across the void between vessels, its armored hull shuddering as we made contact with the bloodied claw's outer airlock. The cutting charges detonated with muffled thunder, and we breached the pirate vessel's hull in a shower of sparks and venting atmosphere. The first thing that struck me was the smell. Even through my rebreather's filters, I could detect the sickly sweet stench of decay mingling with the metallic tang of spilled blood and the acrid bite of burned electronics. The bloodied claw's internal lighting flickered sporadically, casting our shadows in wild, dancing patterns across the corridor walls. Hadris took point, his lasgun sweeping the darkened passage ahead while Vorn's servo skulls flitted through the air like mechanical insects, their sensors probing for signs of life or hostile activity. The ship's corridors were too quiet, lacking the constant background hum of active systems and crew movement that characterized a living vessel. Instead, we heard only the distant groaning of stressed metal and the occasional spark of failing electrical systems. Evidence of hasty evacuation littered the main corridors. Personal effects lay scattered across the deck plates, including data slates, clothing, and half-eaten meals that had been abandoned mid-consumption. A lasgun lay propped against a bulkhead, its power cell still glowing amber, but its owner nowhere to be found. The emergency lighting cast everything in hellish red, transforming familiar shipboard fixtures into menacing shadows. We discovered the first body in the crew quarters, slumped against a wall with his arms wrapped around his knees in a defensive posture. The man's face was frozen in an expression of absolute terror, his eyes wide and staring at something only he could see. Deep gouges marred his throat and chest, but the wounds were unlike anything I had encountered in 20 years of void warfare. The edges were ragged and torn, as if something had worried at the flesh with crude implements rather than the clean cuts of a chainsword or the precise burns of Law's fire. Vorn's examinations revealed more disturbing details. The bite patterns on the corpse's limbs were inconsistent with human dentition, featuring puncture wounds that suggested elongated canines and molars designed for tearing rather than chewing. The spacing between individual tooth marks indicated a jaw structure that was simultaneously familiar and alien, as if someone had taken human anatomy and twisted it into something predatory. The ship's cogitators presented their own mysteries. Vorn interfaced with the primary data core through his mechadendrite connections, his optical sensors flickering as he processed the information streams. The machine spirit's responses were erratic and fragmented, displaying data that seemed to shift and change even as we observed it. Navigation logs showed impossible coordinates that placed the bloodied claw simultaneously in multiple sectors of the galaxy, while crew manifests listed names that dissolved into random characters when scrutinized too closely. More troubling were the internal security recordings. The picked feeds showed normal crew activities up until approximately 16 hours ago, when the images began to degrade into static-filled glimpses of running figures and strobing emergency lights. The audio tracks were worse, filled with screaming voices that seemed to harmonize in ways that hurt to hear, punctuated by wet, tearing sounds that suggested violence of an intimate and personal nature. We found the ship's servitors in the engineering section, their mechanical forms scattered across the deck like broken toys. Someone or something had torn them apart with surgical precision, removing specific components while leaving others untouched. The pattern suggested intimate knowledge of Imperial technology, as if the attacker understood exactly which systems to target for maximum disruption. The servitor designated Epsilon 7 had been completely disassembled, its cybernetic components arranged in neat piles according to function. The creature's organic brain tissue had been carefully extracted from its protective housing and placed in the center of the arrangement like some grotesque centerpiece. Fluid leaked from the exposed neural matter, pooling on the deck plates in patterns that seemed almost deliberate. Hadris discovered additional corpses in the ship's mess hall, their bodies arranged around the central table as if they had been sharing a final meal. The scene was a tableau of interrupted consumption, with food still on plates and drinking vessels overturned in puddles of rakaf and amasak. But the bodies themselves told a different story, bearing the same savage wounds we had encountered throughout the vessel. One corpse was missing its left arm entirely, the limb severed at the shoulder with the same ragged technique that characterized the other injuries. The missing appendage was nowhere to be found, though dark stains on the deck suggested it had been dragged away for purposes I preferred not to contemplate. Another body showed signs of having been partially consumed, with chunks of flesh missing from the torso and thighs in patterns that suggested methodical feeding rather than frenzied attack. The ship's medical bay yielded more questions than answers. The Medicaid equipment had been systematically destroyed, but not through random violence. Someone had taken the time to disable specific systems while leaving others intact, creating a pattern that suggested both technical knowledge and deliberate sabotage. The surgical tools were missing from their sterilization chambers, though bloodstains on the walls indicated they had been put to use somewhere within the facility. Vorn's servo skulls detected trace amounts of human genetic material throughout the medical bay, but the samples were corrupted in ways that defied easy explanation. The DNA sequences contained anomalies that suggested either severe radiation exposure or some form of biological contamination, though no records existed of the bloodied claw encountering either hazard during their recent operations. The ship's armory had been breached from the inside, its blast doors torn open with enough force to warp the reinforced steel. Weapons lay scattered across the floor, many of them damaged beyond repair by what appeared to be desperate close-quarters fighting. Law's burns scarred the walls in wild patterns, suggesting panicked firing at targets that moved with inhuman speed and agility. A pile of spent power cells near the armory's entrance indicated that the crew had made a determined stand in this location, expending enormous amounts of ammunition in a relatively short period. But the lack of alien corpses or equipment suggested that their efforts had been ultimately futile. Whatever they had been fighting, either too resilient to be stopped by conventional weapons or clever enough to avoid leaving evidence of its presence. The bloodied Kloss Bridge was a monument to systematic destruction. Every control station had been methodically dismantled, their components scattered across the deck in patterns that suggested both rage and technical expertise. The captain's command throne sat empty, its occupant nowhere to be found, though bloodstains on the seat indicated violence had occurred in this location. The ship's chronometer had stopped at 0215, though whether this represented the time of the attack or simply another system failure was impossible to determine. The main viewscreen flickered with static-filled images that seemed to show the same corridor from multiple angles, creating a disorienting effect that made my eyes water when I stared at it too long. The return journey to the Prophet's Edge felt longer than it should have, each step through the bloodied, Kloss-corrupted corridors weighing heavily on my mind. The evidence we had gathered painted a picture of systematic slaughter, but the absence of any clear perpetrator left too many questions unanswered. As we sealed the boarding torpedo's airlock behind us, I found myself glancing back at the derelict vessel's darkened viewports, half expecting to see movement in the shadows beyond. Captain Mordian received our initial report with the stoic demeanor that had served him well during 3 decades of void warfare, though I caught the slight tightening around his eyes when I described the condition of the corpses. The bloodied Claw would remain under quarantine until we could determine the exact nature of what had befallen her crew, but the immediate priority was ensuring our own vessel's security. I assigned rotating watch schedules and implemented enhanced security protocols throughout the Prophet's Edge, though the measures felt inadequate against a threat we could not properly identify. The ship's crew went about their duties with the practiced efficiency of experienced void farers, but I noticed the subtle changes in their behavior as word of our discoveries spread through the lower decks. Conversations became more subdued, and men who had served together for years began watching each other with newfound wariness. The first signs of trouble emerged during the third watch cycle, approximately 18 hours after our return from the bloodied Claw. Trooper Kellen, who had accompanied me on the boarding mission, failed to report for his assigned duty shift in the primary cargo hold. When Corporal Hadris went to investigate, he found Kellen's quarters empty except for his uniform, which lay crumpled on the floor as if its owner had shed it in haste. The search for Kellen expanded throughout the ship's lower levels, with teams of armed crew members methodically checking every compartment and service tunnel. The Prophet's Edge was not a large vessel by Imperial Navy standards, but her maze of maintenance passages and storage areas provided countless hiding places for someone who wished to avoid detection. After 6 hours of fruitless searching, I began to suspect that Kellen had somehow departed the ship entirely, though the sealed airlocks and active security systems made such an escape seemingly impossible. We found him in the ship's mess hall during the next meal period, seated at his usual table with a plate of processed protein and reconstituted vegetables. The other crew members gave him a wide berth, their instincts warning them that something was fundamentally wrong despite his apparently normal appearance. Kellen ate with mechanical precision, cutting his food into identical portions and consuming each piece with the same measured rhythm. When I approached his table, Kellen looked up at me with eyes that seemed somehow different, though I could not immediately identify what had changed. His pupils appeared slightly dilated, and his facial muscles held an unnatural stillness that reminded me of the servitors we had discovered aboard the bloodied Claw. When he spoke, his voice carried the same familiar inflections and speech patterns I had known for years, yet something fundamental had shifted in the way he formed his words. Kellen explained his absence as a simple case of exhaustion, claiming he had fallen asleep in one of the lower storage compartments while conducting routine inventory checks. His explanation was plausible enough, and his manner remained calm and reasonable throughout our conversation. but I noticed the way his jaw moved when he spoke, as if the bones had somehow elongated since our last encounter, creating subtle distortions in his facial structure. The changes in Kellen's behavior became more pronounced over the following days. He began spending long periods in the ship's darker sections, claiming to prefer the cooler temperatures and reduced lighting. His dietary habits shifted dramatically, with an increased appetite for the ship's protein rations and a corresponding disinterest in the synthetic vegetables and grains that formed the bulk of our food supplies. When questioned about these preferences, he provided logical explanations that satisfied most of the crew's concerns. More disturbing were the reports from other crew members about Kellen's nocturnal activities. Several men claimed to have heard him moving through the ship's corridors during the sleep cycle, his footsteps echoing from the ventilation shafts and maintenance tunnels with an odd, shuffling gait. When confronted about these nighttime wanderings, Kellen expressed surprise and claimed to have been sleeping soundly in his quarters throughout the periods in question. The transformation spread with insidious efficiency. Trooper Mace, who had also participated in the boarding mission, began exhibiting similar behavioral changes within a week of Kellen's initial symptoms. His appetite increased dramatically, and he developed a preference for consuming his food in private rather than joining the communal meals that had been standard practice aboard the Prophet's Edge. When pressed about his eating habits, Mace became defensive and claimed that the mess hall's lighting gave him severe headaches. Tech Adept Vorn's condition proved more complex due to his extensive cybernetic modifications. The changes in his organic components followed the same pattern as the other affected crew members, but his mechanical systems began displaying erratic behavior that suggested some form of contamination had spread to his augmetic implants. His servo skulls started malfunctioning, their flight patterns becoming erratic and their sensor readings increasingly unreliable. The affected crew members began gathering in small groups during their off-duty periods, congregating in the ship's darker sections, where the emergency lighting cast long shadows across the bulkheads. Their conversations became increasingly difficult to follow, filled with technical jargon and references to subjects that seemed to shift and change even as they spoke. When other crew members attempted to join these discussions, they were politely but firmly excluded through subtle social pressures that left no room for argument. I started noticing physical changes in the affected individuals that went beyond simple behavioral modifications. Their limbs appeared to be lengthening gradually, creating subtle alterations in their proportions that were difficult to detect unless observed over extended periods. Their fingers grew more dexterous but also more angular, with joints that seemed to bend at slightly unnatural angles. The changes were so gradual that individual crew members failed to notice them in their daily interactions. The most disturbing transformation occurred in their facial features. Their jaws began to extend forward in minute increments, creating a subtle prognathism that altered their speech patterns and eating habits. When they smiled, which became increasingly rare, their teeth appeared sharper and more numerous than normal human dentition should allow. The changes were subtle enough that casual observation revealed nothing unusual, but prolonged scrutiny revealed the gradual metamorphosis taking place. The ship's internal Vox system began carrying strange transmissions during the quiet hours of the night cycle. The affected crew members would communicate with each other using frequencies that bordered on the subsonic range, their voices taking on clicking and growling qualities that barely resembled human speech. These communications seemed to follow complex patterns that suggested a form of coordination, though the actual content remained incomprehensible to unaffected listeners. My attempts to isolate the affected individuals met with passive resistance that proved more effective than open defiance. They complied with direct orders but found subtle ways to avoid extended separation from their transformed companions. When assigned to different work details, they would complete their tasks with unusual efficiency and then seek each other out during their free time, gathering in the ship's less monitored sections to engage in their increasingly alien conversations. The situation reached a critical point when I discovered Corporal Hadris consuming raw protein rations in the ship's cold storage compartment. He crouched in the corner like a wild animal, tearing at the processed meat with teeth that had grown noticeably longer and sharper since our boarding mission. When he noticed my presence, he attempted to resume his normal human posture, but the transformation had progressed too far for him to maintain the deception effectively. Hadris tried to explain his behavior as a simple case of hunger, claiming that the ship's standard meal schedule was insufficient for his increased metabolic needs. His voice carried the same clicking undertones that had become common among the affected crew members, and his eyes reflected the emergency lighting with an intensity that suggested structural changes to his optical systems. When he smiled in an attempt to appear reassuring, his elongated canines were clearly visible behind his stretched lips. The realization that the contamination had spread to nearly half of my boarding party forced me to acknowledge the true scope of the threat we faced. Whatever had destroyed the crew of the Bloodied Claw had somehow transferred to the Prophet's Edge, using our own people as vectors for its expansion. The affected individuals retained their human intelligence and memories, but their fundamental nature was changing in ways that made them increasingly dangerous to the uncontaminated crew members. I retreated to the ship's Medicay Bay and activated the emergency lockdown protocols, sealing myself inside the reinforced compartment while I attempted to understand the nature of the contamination. The medical cogitators contained extensive records of the crew's health examinations, including baseline genetic samples that had been taken during their initial recruitment. Comparing these records with recent observations revealed disturbing patterns in the affected individual's biological markers. The ship's internal sensors detected movement throughout the vessel as the transformed crew members began actively hunting for the remaining uncontaminated personnel. Their coordination had improved dramatically, with different groups working together to systematically search each compartment and service tunnel. The Vox channels carried their alien communications as they reported their findings to each other, their voices becoming increasingly inhuman with each transmission. Through the Medicay Bay's reinforced viewport, I watched Kellen and Mace moving through the adjacent corridor with predatory grace. Their movements had acquired a fluid quality that suggested fundamental changes to their skeletal and muscular systems, allowing them to navigate the ship's confined spaces with unnatural efficiency. When they paused to examine the Medicay Bay's sealed entrance, their heads tilted at angles that would have been impossible for normal human anatomy. The medical cogitators revealed the true horror of our situation as I accessed the detailed records of our encounter with the Bloodied Claw. The derelict vessel had encountered a massive space hulk designated Mortis Threnody approximately 3 weeks before our arrival, conducting salvage operations that had yielded significant quantities of ancient technology and preserved biological specimens. The pirates had stored these materials in their ship's hold, including several containers of what appeared to be desiccated organic matter from the Hulk's interior chambers. The contaminated food supplies had been distributed throughout the Bloodied Claw's crew over a period of several days, with the biological agents beginning their work at the cellular level before any external symptoms became apparent. The transformation process was gradual but inexorable, rewriting the victim's genetic structure while preserving their memories and personalities to ensure the continued spread of the infection. Most terrifying was the discovery that the contamination could be transmitted through close contact with affected individuals, explaining how the infection had spread from my boarding party to other crew members despite our quarantine protocols. The microscopic organisms responsible for the transformation were incredibly resilient and could survive in the ship's atmosphere for extended periods, making containment virtually impossible once the initial breach had occurred. The transformed crew members had begun using the ship's ventilation system to move throughout the vessel, their altered physiology allowing them to navigate the narrow ducts and maintenance shafts with ease. Their communications continued to echo through the Vox channels, but the clicking and growling sounds had become so distorted that they barely resembled human speech. The coordination of their search patterns suggested a collective intelligence that transcended individual consciousness. As I sealed the Medicay Bay's secondary blast doors and prepared for what might be a prolonged siege, I could hear the sound of claws scraping against metal as the transformed crew members tested the strength of my defenses. Their patient persistence and methodical approach to breaching the compartment demonstrated that they retained their human intelligence while gaining predatory instincts that made them far more dangerous than simple wild animals. The medical records revealed that the transformation process was irreversible once it reached a certain threshold, with the affected individuals becoming something that was no longer truly human, despite their retained memories and speech patterns. The creatures they were becoming possessed an insatiable hunger for fresh meat and an instinctive drive to spread their contamination to any remaining uninfected hosts. The Medicaid Bay's reinforced walls provided only temporary sanctuary as the transformed crew members began their systematic assault on my defenses. Through the viewport, I watched Kellen's elongated fingers probe the door's locking mechanism with disturbing dexterity, his movements suggesting an intimate understanding of the ship's construction that went beyond his original engineering training. The clicking sounds that emerged from his throat carried complex patterns that seemed to coordinate the efforts of his companions, who had positioned themselves at strategic points throughout the adjacent corridors. My initial plan to wait out the siege proved naive within the first few hours. The creatures had demonstrated remarkable patience, taking turns to test different sections of the Medicaid Bay's perimeter while others disappeared into the ship's ventilation system. The sound of claws scraping against metal echoed from multiple directions, creating an acoustic map of their movements that revealed their growing familiarity with the vessel's hidden passages. They were learning, adapting their tactics based on my defensive responses. The ship's internal sensors painted a grim picture of the situation beyond my sealed compartment. The transformed crew members had established control over the primary corridors, using their knowledge of the Prophet's Edge's layout to create choke points and ambush positions. They moved with predatory coordination, their elongated limbs allowing them to navigate spaces that would have challenged normal human anatomy. When they communicated, their vocalizations carried subsonic frequencies that seemed to resonate through the ship's hull, creating a constant background presence that made concentration difficult. I began repurposing the Medicaid Bay's equipment for defensive purposes, converting surgical lasers into makeshift weapons and rigging the sterilization systems to create barriers of superheated steam. The medical servitors proved more useful than expected, their simple programming allowing me to modify their behavioral protocols without triggering the complex safeguards that protected more sophisticated machine spirits. I sent them into the ventilation system as scouts, their sensor feeds providing glimpses of the creature's movements through the ship's hidden spaces. The first servitor returned with disturbing footage of Mace's transformation, which had progressed far beyond the changes I had observed in the Medicaid Bay. His spine had curved into a pronounced arch that allowed him to move through the narrow ducts with serpentine grace, while his limbs had elongated to the point where his proportions barely resembled human anatomy. Most disturbing was the way his head had begun to reshape itself, the skull extending forward to accommodate rows of sharp teeth that protruded from his stretched jaw. The creatures demonstrated unsettling intelligence in their approach to breaching my defenses. Rather than relying on brute force, they began systematically sabotaging the ship's life support systems, targeting specific components that would force me to abandon my sanctuary. The atmospheric processors started cycling irregularly, creating pressure fluctuations that made breathing difficult. The temperature controls malfunctioned, alternating between freezing cold and stifling heat in patterns that suggested deliberate manipulation. Sleep became impossible as the creatures maintained their vigil outside the Medicaid Bay, their constant movement and alien communications creating a psychological pressure that wore down my mental defenses. When exhaustion finally forced me to rest, I found myself questioning whether the scratching sounds at the walls were real or products of my deteriorating mental state. The boundary between waking observations and stress-induced hallucinations began to blur, making it difficult to assess the true nature of the threats I faced. The ship's cogitators provided access to the internal security network, allowing me to monitor the creature's activities throughout the vessel. They had established a complex hierarchy based on the progression of their transformations, with the most changed individuals directing the actions of those who retained more human characteristics. The coordination extended beyond simple pack behavior, suggesting a collective intelligence that allowed them to share information and adapt their strategies in real time. I watched through the security feeds as the creatures began converting sections of the ship to serve their altered physiology. They tore out unnecessary bulkheads to create larger spaces, while simultaneously blocking passages that might allow uninfected crew members to move freely. The modifications followed logical patterns that demonstrated their retained technical knowledge, combined with instinctive understanding of how to create an environment suited to their predatory nature. The discovery of the cargo hold's transformation came through a servitor that had been exploring the ship's lower levels. The footage revealed a scene that challenged my understanding of the creature's capabilities and intentions. The spacious compartment had been restructured into a series of interconnected chambers, with organic-looking growths covering the walls and ceiling in patterns that suggested deliberate cultivation rather than random infestation. The walls themselves had been modified with materials that appeared to be partially digested metal and organic matter, creating a surface that pulsed with subtle rhythms reminiscent of living tissue. Suspended throughout the space were cocoon-like structures that contained human-shaped forms in various stages of transformation. The prisoners inside these organic pods showed signs of systematic conversion, their bodies being gradually rebuilt according to the same template that had affected my boarding party. The breeding chamber's design revealed the true scope of the creature's reproductive strategy. They were not simply transforming existing crew members, but actively cultivating new specimens through a process that combined elements of biological infection and technological integration. The cocoons contained both recently captured victims and what appeared to be entirely new organisms grown from harvested genetic material, suggesting a level of biological sophistication that went beyond simple mutation. The servitor's sensors detected complex chemical processes occurring within the chamber, with the organic growths producing compounds that seemed to accelerate the transformation process. The atmosphere inside the cargo hold had been altered to support these biological functions, creating an environment that was simultaneously alien and disturbingly familiar. The creatures had essentially created a factory for producing more of their kind, using the ship's resources and captured crew members as raw materials. The psychological impact of witnessing this breeding operation pushed me closer to the edge of complete mental breakdown. The systematic nature of the creature's reproductive process suggested long-term planning and intelligence that made them far more dangerous than simple predators. They were not just hunting the remaining crew members, but actively working to expand their numbers and establish a permanent presence aboard the Prophet's Edge. The security feeds revealed that several crew members I had assumed were dead had actually been captured and transported to the breeding chamber for conversion. Their partially transformed bodies hung suspended in the organic cocoons, their faces displaying expressions of conscious awareness that suggested they remained mentally active throughout the horrifying process. The creatures were not simply killing their victims, but subjecting them to a fate that was arguably worse than death. My attempts to disrupt the breeding operation through the ship's automated systems met with limited success. The creatures had anticipated such interference and had established redundant biological systems that could maintain the chamber's functions even if the mechanical components were disabled. They had also posted guards throughout the lower levels, using their enhanced senses to detect any attempts at sabotage before they could be implemented. The constant stress and isolation began affecting my perception of reality in ways that made it difficult to distinguish between genuine threats and paranoid delusions. I started seeing movement in the shadows beyond the Medicay Bay's viewports, though the security feeds showed no creatures in those locations. The sound of scratching at the walls continued even when the sensors detected no physical contact, suggesting that my mind was creating auditory hallucinations to fill the gaps in my deteriorating awareness. The creatures seemed to recognize my psychological vulnerability and began exploiting it through subtle psychological warfare. They would appear at the edge of my vision and then vanish when I turned to look directly at them, creating a constant sense of being watched without providing concrete evidence of their presence. The pattern of their movements around the Medike Bay followed rhythms that seemed designed to disrupt my sleep cycle and maintain a state of constant alertness that would eventually lead to complete mental exhaustion. The ship's automated systems began malfunctioning in ways that suggested deliberate sabotage rather than random technical failures. The lighting would flicker in patterns that created disorienting strobe effects, while the atmospheric processors would suddenly activate at maximum capacity, creating pressure waves that made it difficult to maintain balance. The creatures were using their technical knowledge to transform the ship itself into a weapon against my sanity. I realized that the Medike Bay's defenses were not designed to withstand a prolonged siege, and my supplies of food and water were running dangerously low. The creatures had effectively cut off all external support, forcing me to choose between starvation and abandoning my sanctuary to search for resources. The psychological pressure of this situation was exactly what they had intended, using my basic survival needs to force me into a position where I would have to confront them directly. The servitors I had sent to scout the ship's corridors began returning with increasingly disturbing reports. The creatures had started setting elaborate traps throughout the vessel, using their knowledge of my behavioral patterns to predict my likely movements and prepare ambush positions accordingly. They had studied my responses to their previous activities and were now using that information to create scenarios that would force me into predetermined killing zones. The traps themselves demonstrated a level of sophistication that went beyond simple predatory instincts. They had rigged sections of the ship's flooring to collapse under specific weight distributions while simultaneously blocking alternative routes that might allow escape. The creatures had also begun using the ship's automated systems against me, reprogramming maintenance servitors to attack anyone who entered certain areas and modifying the atmospheric controls to create pockets of toxic gas in strategic locations. The realization that I was no longer dealing with transformed humans, but with something that had retained human intelligence while gaining predatory capabilities, forced me to completely reassess my survival strategy. The creatures were not simply hunting me, but were actively working to drive me towards specific locations where they could capture me alive for integration into their breeding program. Every move I made was being anticipated, encountered by opponents who understood both my psychology and the ship's layout better than I did. The Medike Bay's walls began showing signs of structural stress as the creatures intensified their efforts to breach my defenses. The reinforced metal was developing hairline cracks that suggested they were using tools or weapons more sophisticated than simple claws and teeth. The systematic nature of their attack patterns indicated they were working to specific engineering principles, targeting load-bearing points and structural weaknesses that would allow them to collapse entire sections of the compartment. The Vox unit crackled to life at precisely 0600 hours, jerking me from the restless half-sleep that had become my only respite within the Medike Bay's confines. The transmission originated from the Prophet's Edge, my own ship, and the voice that emerged from the speakers belonged to Engine Seer Kine. His words carried the familiar cadence of technical reports, but underneath the mundane discussion of plasma drive efficiency and atmospheric recycling rates, I detected the same clicking undertones that had marked the transformation of my boarding party. Kine described routine maintenance procedures with excessive detail, his augmetic voice processing unit struggling to mask the subtle changes in his vocal patterns. He spoke of discovering contaminated salvage materials in the cargo bay, items we had retrieved from the bloodied claw during our initial boarding operation. The infection had somehow survived the transit between vessels, using the very objects we had hoped to study as vectors for its expansion into my own crew. The transmission continued for nearly an hour, with Kine providing updates on the systematic conversion of the Prophet's Edge's personnel. He described the process with clinical detachment, noting how individual crew members had begun exhibiting behavioral changes similar to those I had witnessed aboard the derelict raider. The transformation was proceeding according to the same timeline, with affected individuals gathering in the ship's darker sections, while their physical forms underwent gradual but irreversible alterations. The horror of the situation became clear as Kine detailed the establishment of breeding chambers throughout the Prophet's Edge lower decks. The creatures had used their retained technical knowledge to modify the ship's internal structure, creating organic cultivation areas that mirrored the facility I had discovered in the bloodied Kloss cargo hold. The infection was not merely spreading, but actively working to establish permanent footholds aboard both vessels. Additional transmissions followed throughout the day, each one featuring voices I recognized from years of service together. Navigator Thane reported course corrections that would take the Prophet's Edge toward populated Imperial worlds, his words carrying the same alien undertones that marked his transformation. The creatures were using the ship's navigation systems to spread their contamination beyond the immediate area, potentially infecting entire planetary populations if their plan succeeded. Chief Bosun Varrick described the systematic conversion of the ship's remaining uninfected crew members, his report delivered with the same matter-of-fact tone he had once used for routine personnel evaluations. The creatures had refined their capture techniques, using coordinated hunting strategies to isolate individual targets and transport them to the breeding chambers for transformation. The process was becoming increasingly efficient as the infected crew members gained experience with their new predatory capabilities. The realization that both vessels were now under the creature's control forced me to confront the true scope of the threat we faced. The infection had successfully established itself aboard two ships, with the potential to spread throughout the sector if either vessel reached an inhabited system. The creatures retained enough human intelligence to operate complex Imperial technology while possessing the biological adaptability to survive in hostile environments. My attempts to establish communication with Imperial authorities met with systematic interference from the creatures' control of both ships' Vox systems. They had anticipated such efforts and had modified the transmission arrays to prevent any outgoing signals that might alert nearby vessels to the danger. The isolation was complete, with no possibility of outside assistance or warning other Imperial forces about the spreading contamination. The bloodied Kloss automated systems provided my only remaining option for containing the threat. The ship's self-destruct mechanisms were designed to prevent capture by enemy forces, with multiple redundant systems that could overload the plasma drives and create a controlled fusion explosion. The destruction of both vessels would eliminate the immediate danger while preventing the creatures from reaching populated worlds. My journey through the derelict Raiders' corridors revealed the extent of the creatures' defensive preparations. They had established guard positions at critical junction points, using their enhanced senses to detect any movement through the ship's passages. The transformed crew members moved with predatory grace through spaces that would have challenged normal human anatomy, their elongated limbs allowing them to navigate the vessel's confined areas with disturbing efficiency. The ship's engineering section had been heavily modified to prevent exactly the type of sabotage I was attempting. The creatures had used their retained technical knowledge to create redundant control systems that could maintain critical functions, even if the primary mechanisms were disabled. They had also established biological monitoring networks that could detect unauthorized access to sensitive areas and coordinate defensive responses. The primary self-destruct controls had been physically altered, with organic growths covering the activation mechanisms and creating biological locks that required specific chemical signatures to open. The creatures had essentially transformed the ship's most critical systems into extensions of their own biology, making it impossible to trigger the destruction sequence through conventional means. The level of integration suggested they had been planning for such contingencies since the initial outbreak. The secondary destruction systems proved equally well defended, with the creatures having established permanent guard positions around the plasma drive control chambers. The transformed crew members showed no signs of fatigue or boredom, maintaining their vigilant watch with the patience of predators waiting for prey. Their coordination was perfect, with individuals rotating through different positions according to patterns that suggested collective intelligence rather than individual decision-making. The discovery of alternative destruction methods came through careful examination of the ship's power distribution network. The creatures had focused their defensive efforts on the obvious targets while overlooking more subtle vulnerabilities in the vessel's infrastructure. The plasma conduits that fed the ship's primary systems could be overloaded through cascade failures in the secondary power grid, creating the same catastrophic result as the official self-destruct sequence. The process required precise timing and coordination between multiple system failures, with each step building on the previous one to create an unstoppable chain reaction. The creature's biological monitoring systems were designed to detect direct sabotage, but were less effective at recognizing the subtle manipulations needed to trigger a cascade failure. The approach would take longer to implement, but offered better chances of success against their sophisticated defenses. The engineering work required moving through sections of the ship that the creatures had claimed as their territory, forcing me to navigate around their patrol patterns while avoiding the biological sensors they had established throughout the vessel. The transformed crew members had developed hunting strategies that took advantage of their enhanced senses, using sound and scent to track targets through the ship's maze of corridors and maintenance passages. The first phase of the sabotage involved overloading the secondary power couplings that fed the ship's atmospheric processors. The creatures had established these systems as critical infrastructure, making them less likely to notice subtle modifications to the power flow regulators. The work required careful manipulation of the coupling mechanisms, introducing instabilities that would cascade through the entire network once the sequence was initiated. The plasma conduit modifications proved more challenging due to the creature's heavy presence in the engineering sections. They had established breeding chambers in the areas closest to the ship's power core, using the heat and energy output to accelerate their reproductive processes. The constant activity made it difficult to approach the critical systems without detection, forcing me to time my movements according to their patrol schedules. The creature's collective intelligence became apparent as they began adapting their defensive strategies in response to my sabotage efforts. They started posting additional guards at locations I had previously accessed, while simultaneously modifying their patrol patterns to eliminate the gaps I had been exploiting. The speed of their adaptation suggested they were sharing information instantaneously, creating a hive mind that could respond to threats more effectively than individual defenders. The final phase of the destruction sequence required simultaneous activation of multiple cascade points throughout both vessels. The creatures had established communication links between the Bloodied Claw and the Prophet's Edge, allowing them to coordinate their activities across both ships. The same network could be used to trigger synchronized overloads that would destroy both vessels before the creatures could implement countermeasures. The approach to the primary plasma conduit required passing through the ship's central breeding chamber, where the creatures had established their most sophisticated conversion facility. The organic growths covering the walls pulsed with complex rhythms that suggested active biological processes, while the suspended cocoons contained both captured crew members and newly cultivated organisms in various stages of development. The sight confirmed that the creatures were not simply transforming existing humans, but actively creating new specimens from harvested genetic material. The massive entity that dominated the breeding chamber's center represented the culmination of the creature's reproductive strategy. The thing had been constructed from the remains of the Bloodied Claw's entire original crew, their bodies fused together into a single organism that retained aspects of individual identity while functioning as a collective consciousness. The creature's multiple faces showed expressions of retained personality, but their voices harmonized in ways that created a unified communication system. The amalgamated entity demonstrated intimate knowledge of both vessels' technical systems, having absorbed the memories and expertise of every crew member it had consumed. It spoke through multiple mouths simultaneously, creating complex harmonies that conveyed information more efficiently than normal human speech. The creature's collective memory contained decades of void warfare experience, making it a formidable opponent that could anticipate and counter most conventional tactics. The entity's physical form defied easy description, with limbs and sensory organs positioned according to functional requirements rather than anatomical logic. It had grown specialized appendages for manipulating the ship's controls while developing enhanced sensory capabilities that allowed it to monitor activities throughout both vessels. The creature represented the ultimate expression of the infection's adaptive potential, combining human intelligence with predatory instincts and biological flexibility. The confrontation with the amalgamated entity required careful timing to avoid its multiple sensory organs while accessing the plasma conduit controls. The creature's collective consciousness made it difficult to predict its responses, as it could simultaneously process information from multiple perspectives and coordinate complex defensive strategies. The battle became a test of individual cunning against collective intelligence, with the outcome depending on which approach proved more effective. The activation of the cascade failure sequence triggered immediate responses from creatures throughout both vessels. They recognized the threat and began implementing countermeasures designed to prevent the plasma overloads from reaching critical levels. The speed of their response demonstrated the effectiveness of their collective intelligence, but the cascade had already progressed beyond the point where conventional safeguards could stop it. The destruction of both ships created a brief but intense fusion reaction that eliminated all biological traces of the infection. The plasma drives overloaded simultaneously, creating a combined explosion that vaporized both vessels and their contents. The creature's collective consciousness was severed as their physical forms were consumed by the stellar temperature fires, ending their threat to the immediate area. The final moments before the explosion revealed the true scope of the creature's contingency planning. Emergency pods had been launched from both vessels during the early stages of the cascade failure, their trajectories calculated to reach nearby Imperial worlds within standard shipping lanes. The pods contained biological samples and partially transformed organisms that could survive extended periods in vacuum, ensuring the infection's survival, even if the primary breeding facilities were destroyed. The sight of the escape pods disappearing into the void confirmed that the horror would continue to spread throughout the sector. The creatures had planned for the possibility of losing their primary breeding facilities and had prepared alternative methods for establishing new footholds on populated worlds. The destruction of the Bloodied Claw and Prophet's Edge had eliminated the immediate threat, but had also scattered the infection across multiple star systems. The realization that I had achieved only a Pyrrhic victory haunted my final moments as the plasma fires consumed the Medicae Bay. The creatures had demonstrated remarkable adaptability and long-term planning capabilities that made them far more dangerous than simple predators. They had used human intelligence and technical knowledge to create a reproductive strategy that could survive even catastrophic setbacks, ensuring their continued expansion throughout Imperial space. The emergency pods carried enough biological material to establish new breeding facilities on any world they reached, with the infection's adaptive capabilities allowing it to survive in diverse environments. The creatures had essentially transformed themselves into a plague that could spread through normal shipping and trade routes, using Imperial infrastructure to facilitate their expansion across the galaxy. The destruction of both vessels had prevented the immediate threat to nearby populated worlds, but had also alerted the creatures to the vulnerability of their centralized breeding strategy. Future outbreaks would likely be more distributed and harder to contain, with the infection learning from each encounter to become more resilient and adaptable. The horror I had witnessed aboard the Bloodied Claw and Prophet's Edge was merely the beginning of a threat that would plague the Imperium for generations to come. The final transmission from the escape pods confirmed the creature's success in preserving their reproductive potential. The biological samples contained within the emergency vessels retained their transformative properties, ensuring that any world they reached would become a new breeding ground for the infection. The creatures had achieved their primary objective of spreading beyond their original location, using the very measures intended to contain them as vehicles for their expansion. As the plasma fires reached the Medicae Bay's reinforced walls, I understood that my sacrifice had bought the Imperium only temporary respite from a threat that would continue to evolve and adapt. The creatures had demonstrated the ability to learn from their mistakes and improve their strategies, making them increasingly dangerous with each encounter. The horror that had begun aboard a single pirate vessel would soon spread throughout the sector, carried by the emergency pods that even now raced toward unsuspecting Imperial worlds. The infection had successfully transformed from a localized outbreak into a sector-wide threat, using human intelligence and Imperial technology to ensure its survival and expansion. The creatures had proven that they could adapt to any countermeasure and turn defensive actions into opportunities for growth. The destruction of the Bloodied Claw and Prophet's Edge marked not the end of the threat, but the beginning of a new phase in its evolution, one that would challenge the Imperium's ability to contain and eliminate biological hazards that combined human cunning with alien adaptability.